Thanks for listening to the Best of Outkick the Coverage podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the Coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis on Fox Sports Radio.
What now becomes, by far, the biggest story in the NFL over the ensuing days, weeks, and potentially months is what's going to happen with Aaron Rodgers and also what's going to happen with Deshaun Watson. And what's interesting is I want to unpack and discuss in pretty good detail, part of the time with my lawyer hat on, where I think these stories are going and why they matter so much in the larger scale here. So let's start with the idea of Aaron Rodgers. I always like to go, as those of you out there who listen to the show regularly know, I like to go to the gambling markets and see what they are telling us about potential destinations. FanDuel.com/Clay, I can go there and I can look at them. And by the way, we're going to talk, we're scheduled to anyway, to Todd Furman in the second hour, so I'll have him break down this even better than I can do. But what the gambling markets are telling us is that Aaron Rodgers is potentially headed to Denver. Because the gambling markets have taken the Denver Broncos from around a 65 or 66 to 1 Super Bowl contender. That means for every $1, you would get back 66. They were a big underdog, not considered one of the best teams in the NFL by far. In fact, considered one of the worst teams in the NFL. To, as rumors have continued to circle, that Aaron Rodgers is potentially headed to the Denver Broncos, that number is now around 20 to 1 at a variety of different places. Why have those numbers moved? And why have we also saw the Green Bay Packers start to back up as a favorite as well in the Super Bowl marketplace? It's because there is a lot of smoke that Aaron Rodgers is going to go to Denver. And that's where I believe he is going to take his first snap of the 2021 season. I believe Aaron Rodgers will play. I think the Broncos will work out a trade with the Packers to ship Aaron Rodgers from the NFC to the AFC based on what I have heard, based on reading the markets. I think Aaron Rodgers to the Denver Broncos is going to happen. Other clear indication that it might happen was what happened on Thursday. Sitting at the ninth spot, the Denver Broncos had the opportunity to draft Justin Fields or Mac Jones, and instead they decided to opt for a corner. That's despite the fact that the only two real quarterbacks on their roster right now are Drew Lock and Teddy Bridgewater. And neither of those guys makes very much money. I think combined, they are going to cost the Broncos around $5 million at the quarterback position. That is nothing in the grand scheme of things. There is not a single team that has a quarterback duo that costs less than that in the entirety of the NFL. So the Broncos had a really clear opportunity to go get Justin Fields at 9, to go get Mac Jones at 9, to decide to draft their quarterback of the future, and they passed on it. Why would they pass on it, given how good those options were and how many rumors there were out there that Justin Fields in particular was a guy that the Broncos wanted? Instead, they let the Bears trade up at 11 and go get Justin Fields, and they themselves passed on Fields and on Mac Jones. The only real reason to me that is rational for the Broncos to have made that choice, so I guess you could say they didn't like either quarterback, that's always a possibility, but it's because I think they believe they are going to get Aaron Rodgers signed, sealed, and delivered in Denver, and that is what the gambling markets are telling us right now. So Aaron Rodgers goes public on Thursday, says, I want out. The gambling markets continue to move in a direction that discusses and debates would say, instead of me just sitting here talking to you about it, the dollars are coming in on the Broncos in a way that reflects that Aaron Rodgers is likely to be going there. And the dollars are coming off of the Green Bay Packers in a way that suggests that Aaron Rodgers may be moving from there. Now, the gambling markets can fluctuate. There certainly are still a lot of details to be worked out, but I think that's the number one story that we are being told right now in the NFL in the offseason. Okay, That's the Aaron Rodgers side of the equation. Here's the other biggest story in the NFL that's going on. Deshaun Watson. And I keep talking about this story because, frankly, the silence is stunning to me. 22 different women have accused Deshaun Watson of sexual assault. The Houston Texans made the decision with their first pick in the draft. Remember, they didn't have a first or a second round guy to go get Davis Mills out of Stanford. Why did they do that? Because they are desperate, I believe, to try and figure out their quarterback position. Right now, there aren't a lot of available players that are proven, and theoretically, the Houston Texans are now Tyrod Taylor's team with Davis Mills potentially able to challenge him. That is the weakest, even weaker than the Broncos, who with Drew Lock and with Teddy Bridgewater. To me, by far, the Houston Texans now have a historically weak quarterback duo in the history of the NFL. Been a lot of bad quarterback duos, but Tyrod Taylor, not very good. And so far, we have no idea what Davis Mills is going to be capable of. So a historically bad duo, and the Texans didn't have a lot of other options out there among quarterbacks. They don't want to give up any more picks. So reading the tea leaves, it was not surprising that they went in and grabbed Davis Mills. But what that pick tells me is that Deshaun Watson is done in Houston. Now, it remains to be seen whether Deshaun Watson has any substantial trade value. But I think the Texans, by taking Davis Mills, are effectively letting everybody know, hey, we're done with Deshaun Watson. We don't think he's going to play in 2021. We are finished with our future franchise quarterback now. And I think, as I've been saying for a long time, there are legitimate questions about how long Deshaun Watson is going to be out, particularly as it pertains to whether or not there might be criminal charges brought in Houston against him, which would add even more difficulty to this situation. But where I see these two stories connected is you had quarterbacks who went public and demanded trades. Now, there's a big difference to me between Aaron Rodgers at the age of 37 being fed up with 9 of the 10 first-round picks of the Broncos over the last decade being defensive players, and also the only first-round pick who's been an offensive player being Jordan Love. So I don't, and Deshaun Watson was just upset over the way that the Bill O'Brien basically managed the Houston Texans. But remember, when Bill O'Brien, for instance, went to go get Laremy Tunsil and gave up all the assets that he did, he wasn't anticipating that the Houston Texans were going to fall to 4-12. He thought Laremy Tunsil was going to be able to protect the blind side of his franchise quarterback. That move was made with Deshaun Watson in mind. So that shouldn't really be something that Deshaun Watson is angry about, because the 4-12 Texans ending up having to trade a third overall pick, nobody would have really anticipated, certainly not Bill O'Brien, that the Texans would fall flat on their face there with a healthy Deshaun Watson. In fact, if you want to spin forward a negative narrative, it would be, hey, Deshaun Watson, you're angry about going 4-12, but with the money that the Texans have committed to you, that's the reason why they commit that money to you, so that 4-12 never becomes a reality as long as you're healthy. You played in all 16 games and the team still stunk. That is partly your fault because, again, the Laremy Tunsil trade was about trying to protect you. So I think the Texans are letting it be known that they're done with Deshaun Watson. I tossed this out a bit yesterday, but I want to expand upon it right now. If I were the Houston Texans, I would be on the phone right now with the Green Bay Packers saying, hey, we'll trade you Deshaun Watson for Aaron Rodgers. Now, I don't know that Aaron Rodgers would agree to play with Houston. I think certainly he wants to win a championship, and it doesn't feel like the Houston Texans are very close to being able to contend for a championship, so I think Aaron Rodgers would shoot it down. But the reason why I would make that call is you don't know exactly what the Packers might be willing to say as it pertains to Deshaun Watson. It's a major risk, and I think a lot of owners would run in the opposite direction to even think about grabbing Deshaun Watson. But it's a conversation that I think should happen. And there aren't that many teams that are desperate enough to make a deal like that. I'll give you another one. A part of me, and I know the Steelers are an expertly run franchise, But the Steelers right now have an aging quarterback in Ben Roethlisberger. They have got Mason Rudolph, who it appears they're going to give a chance to be the guy to replace Ben Roethlisberger based on the contract that they've signed him. Mike Tomlin does an incredible job either getting guys to buy in or shipping them out of town. Le'Veon Bell didn't buy in. He's basically been unheard of since. To his credit, he found a way, Antonio Brown did, to win a Super Bowl ring, but the star-crossed tenure of Antonio Brown after he left Pittsburgh suggests that Mike Tomlin is a great coach at not only being able to, you know, sort of motivate his guys, but also at keeping all sorts of dissension in-house. So a part of me, if I were the Pittsburgh Steelers, would be potentially inquiring about the idea of Deshaun Watson. Again, because in a year, you're going to have to move on from Ben Roethlisberger maybe. Maybe you take the risk on Deshaun Watson right now. Same thing with Washington. Ron Rivera's team is stacked on the defensive side of the ball. I think they're actually going to be one of the surprises. It wouldn't stun me if they won the NFC East this year if Ryan Fitzpatrick can just play decent and consistent, which has always been sort of the challenge for him. Fitzmagic can go up and down in a big way, game to game, certainly month to month. There's not a lot of consistency to it. But if he could play well, they're a contender. If he doesn't play well, if I'm Washington, I'm getting on the phone with Houston. Because I think, based on drafting Davis Mills, that the Texans would love to wash their hands of Deshaun Watson. And I think the price that Deshaun Watson would cost right now is so far down the flow chart that if you have, this is honestly one of those rare situations where you need a great legal team. Like we talked yesterday about Dr. David Chow and the importance of being able to have a good medical advising team to look over all the details as it pertains to whether or not a guy's going to be able to be healthy or not in the season, whether he's going to have a long career as a part of the draft. This is where you need like a team of high-end legal advisors and say, okay, what's the worst case scenario for Deshaun Watson? I'll tell you, the worst case scenario is he never plays another football game. Best case scenario, he settles all 22 of these civil charges, never any criminal charges filed. He gets suspended for 6 or 8 games as a result, and he's able to play even by the end of the 2021 season. Regardless, the Texans are willing to move on from him. If you were willing to give up a 2022 first-round draft pick, even if you don't know where that pick is going to be, I think it's possible that you could get Deshaun Watson. If I'm the Steelers, if I am the Washington football team, those are calls that I am making right now. And while I think Aaron Rodgers is likely going to Denver, I also think that's a call that the Denver Broncos should make. Because even if you have to deal with that risk, I think what you could say as an owner or a GM is, look, we're not, here's what I would say, right? If I had to go talk to the media, we're not making any determination about the legal issues that are facing Deshaun Watson. We are making a determination based on the talent on the football field that we have seen from Deshaun Watson. We believe he's going to resolve his legal issues with the NFL, with the civil courts, everyone involved here at some point in the near future. And when that happens, if he is then eligible to go to the football field, we think we are getting a heck of a football player who has learned a lot about the dangers in the way that he has to carry himself in the future. And we thought, based on conversations with Deshaun Watson and his representatives, that putting him in an entirely new city and an entirely new environment was the right choice. I understand you're going to criticize our decision because of the off-the-field related incidents, but that is my thought process, that we are getting a good player who is going to be a better person than he has been in the past in the years ahead. He's still very young, and I believe we are getting him at a cost where the benefit outweighs the risk. And so that's what I would say if I were the GM. If I were an owner, I would be willing to take the slings and arrows of criticism that would come from going to get Deshaun Watson. And I would take the risk that he might be out for a substantial period of time, because I think the payoff in the event that he is able to play again is potentially worth it in a substantial way. So I floated the idea of the Packers having an interest in Deshaun Watson because of the issue with Aaron Rodgers. I haven't heard anybody else talking about it. I would say the Denver Broncos, who I think is going to get Aaron, who are going to get Aaron Rodgers based on the odds markets. I would also make a call about Deshaun Watson. And just looking at the larger scope and universe out there, Washington and Pittsburgh are going to be in the quarterback market by next year. You can wait, but if Deshaun Watson resolves all these issues, his cost is going to go up. You lose some of your negotiating leverage. Right now, the weekend after, the Houston Texans have gone and drafted Davis Mills. I don't know how they could give you any clearer of a sign that they want out of the Deshaun Watson business than what they are saying right now. And I think now would be the time to potentially pounce and consider, if you have good legal experts and if they are analyzing this case in a smart way, potentially making the move on from Deshaun Watson and trying to get him for a relatively reduced price. Now, the downside there remains, it's possible that Deshaun Watson never plays another football game. It's possible that he is never out there again, ever on the field. And I think that is the danger, but I think the risk reward now is potentially out there for somebody who's willing to take that risk and who is willing to take the criticism that comes with taking that risk. I'll ask Paul Kaharsky about this here in a minute. He is one of the newest members of the OutKick universe. He is in the OutKick 360, and he will join us to break down everything that happened in the NFL draft from his perspective. Quarterbacks out there, the five that went in the top 15, does he buy into my theory about Davis Mills going to the Texans and what a big deal that is, and many other angles to hit in the world of the NFL draft. That will be in the next segment.
This is OutKick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
NFL draft reaction obviously continuing. I've talked a lot about the Aaron Rodgers situation, Deshaun Watson, and why I think the Davis Mills draft pick was such a significant story, even though it's not being talked about a ton. We got a crazy Zach Wilson story with the Jets that I'm going to dive into. Many different directions to head as we continue to work our way throughout the course of the program. But I didn't, and I do think this is kind of a ridiculous fun story that we talked about some on OutKick that I don't think it got a lot of attention elsewhere. So many of you will remember that Vanderbilt kicker Sarah Fuller was a member of the women's soccer team at Vanderbilt. And this past fall, they turned Sarah Fuller coming in to kick a couple of extra points into one of the woke super stories of the entire universe. This idea that Sarah Fuller, oh my God, she's saving Vanderbilt. Otherwise, they would never be able to kick any extra points. None of this made sense, right? And it was like, if you mentioned any of the facts that pointed out that this was a sham and that this was just designed to kind of draw attention without actually being legitimate, people were like, oh, it's so sexist of you to even point that out. But I was like, wait a minute. They have a kicker who is attempting field goals. They have a punter. You're telling me that the kicker that is kicking 40-plus yard field goals isn't able to jog onto the field and actually kick extra points, that this is necessary? This is a total sham, and more power to it if it's just being treated as a way to get attention. But she's addressing the team at halftime. She's talking about the effort and the intensity. And people were acting, they named her the SEC Player of the Week on special teams. People are acting like this is real when in reality, it's a total sham. And some people got mad at me. People were like, how dare you? Why would you even share that opinion, right? Like, because blue check marks on Twitter all have the exact same opinion. So this won't get hardly any attention anywhere else. And the amount of stories like these that almost receive no attention but for OutKick continue to grow. Sarah Fuller, Vanderbilt women's soccer goalie, who has supposedly got such an amazing leg, is such an incredible soccer player. She got benched by the Vanderbilt women's soccer team in the biggest game of the year, their NCAA tournament game against Penn State, for a freshman goalie on the Vanderbilt women's soccer team. So all season, like, we heard, oh, she's so great, she's such an incredible kicker, she's amazing. They didn't even use her in the most important game of the year in the sport that she actually plays and is on scholarship to play. And we're supposed to believe that she is necessary for the Vanderbilt football team? This is why so many of these stories, if you ask any questions at all, just immediately blow up. My first thought is, if you want to just kind of make a joke, Vanderbilt should have been using this other kicker, right? She's not even the best goalie on her team. Why was Vanderbilt using her? She's not even the best women's soccer player they could have picked, because she wasn't even starting in the most important game of the year that they played in Vanderbilt women's soccer. And by the way, this is not a shot at her. She was used as a way to make a statement that had nothing to do with the meritocracy of sports. See, the reason, one of the primary reasons why I love sports so much is so much of American life today is total BS. But there is an authenticity to sports that is almost impossible to replicate anywhere else. Best man or best woman wins. You want to prove that you're the fastest person? Line up and run and prove it. Now, obviously, we can get into all different sorts of steroids and everything else, but let's pretend that everybody's clean at the Olympics. You can find out who the fastest man or the fastest woman in the entire world is, because we got a track and you have to prove it time after time after time. If you are the best kicker in the NFL or the best kicker in college football, over time, you will prove that based on your ability to make kicks. But don't sell me on the idea that a stunt is real life, okay? And I'm okay with stunts when it's acknowledged that it's a stunt. I don't have a problem when a kid is at a spring game and you decide that you want to let the kid score a touchdown, right? This is kind of a feel-good moment that might happen in a spring game where you're not keeping score, and an 8-year-old kid gets a football and he runs around the corner and the team lets him score. I think that is really kind of awesome, honestly. And that is not making a mockery of the sport itself, because it's not a real contest. But when you bring somebody in a real contest and try to sell us on the idea that this is a remarkable achievement because nobody else could do what this person is doing, and everyone out there with a functional brain knows that this is not the case, I feel like we live in a fundamentally artificial universe when almost no one else will say anything because they're so afraid that people might be mean to them on Twitter. So that's why this is a story. Sarah Fuller is supposedly such an amazing kicker that she saved Vanderbilt by coming in and kicking 2 extra points, which is a total lie. But she wasn't even good enough in her primary sport, according to the coach who's theoretically trying to win that sport, to even start in that game against Penn State, I believe it was, in the NCAA tournament. How can you sell me on her talent being so impressive and so incredible in the world of college football, which is what all the blue checks tried to do, when she's not even good enough to start in the most important game of the season on her team and she gets benched? She's not even the best at the sport that she actually plays, and we were being sold the lie that she was the best kicker available on Vanderbilt's campus. It was a lie. It was a sham. It was a stunt. And some people say, well, why do you have to call it out? Because competition, what I believe in is, in games that matter, what you owe every person out there is you're going to compete your absolute hardest to try to win the game. You may not win. You're going to coach the absolute hardest to try to win the game. That's what competition is to me. That's how you end up with success in life, is being able and willing to compete as hard as you can every single day. Sometimes you're going to win, sometimes you're going to lose, but the lessons of putting yourself out there in athletics translates into so many other different parts of life. And we all got sold a bill of goods, and OutKick was one of the only places that was willing to raise this as a bill of goods. And I bet you won't hear anywhere else all those guys out there slinging the story about her being the best kicker on Vanderbilt. Will they even mention that she got benched from her own women's soccer team? I bet not. Facts matter. So does truth. So does honesty. Competition at the highest echelon is the absolute apex of what we should aspire to in all sports. This is OutKick. Up next, Todd Furman on Fox Sports Radio.
This is OutKick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
Hey, it's Ben, host of The Fifth Hour with Ben Maller, along with my trusty sidekick, David Gascon. Would mean a lot to have you join us on our weekly auditory journey. You're asking, what in God's name is The Fifth Hour? I'll tell you, it's a spinoff of The Ben Maller Show, a cult hit overnights on FSR. Why should you listen? Picture, if you will, a world where we chat with captains of industry in media, sports, and more every week. Explore some amazing facts about human nature and more. Listen to The Fifth Hour with Ben Maller on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
We bring in now my buddy Todd Furman, is a co-host alongside of me on Fox Bet Live, which airs at 5 o'clock Eastern, 4 o'clock Central, 3 o'clock Mountain, 2 o'clock Pacific. So later today we will be talking as well. But Furman, I want to start with you because I think that the gambling markets associated with the NFL draft made the draft wildly more entertaining than it ordinarily would, because it gave people a reasonable, like, dollar figure to be paying attention to as it pertains to where people might be drafted, as opposed to just a lot of the hot air that is often out there where a new mock draft comes out. And the biggest and best story associated with that was what happened with the San Francisco 49ers, as the odds markets jumped around quite a bit. Justin Fields was favored, Mac Jones was favored multiple times. And then on the day of the draft, boom, Trey Lance suddenly started to surge. The money told us what the story was on draft day.
Yeah, I always think when you have a market, that's typically going to be a better indicator of speculation, because money speaks volumes. Although the one thing I will say, we did see money coming on Trey Lance, but it wasn't as though the number got bet out of control. Typically, you can see those prices go from him being a slight underdog to a 1-10 favorite, and we had gone, hey, we know exactly who the 49ers are going to take. So the fact that the number started to drift out, there was a little bit of buyback that came in on the rest of the field, told me that, hey, nobody really knows exactly what the 49ers are going to do other than a handful of folks out there. One thing I will say, though, about the draft, there's no doubt that increased amounts of wagering on it definitely make it a much more compelling event. But I put out a poll to my audience, and I usually like to think it's a somewhat representative cross-section of the gambling community. 65% of those people that responded in the poll said they weren't going to bet the draft. So I think it's still a market that has a lot of upside out there as people get more and more comfortable. But sometimes, as you always know, the Twitterverse isn't all just indicative of how people necessarily view it as a truly wagerable event.
No doubt. But would you buy into this argument that I made yesterday? The three biggest sports in America in order, the NFL, college football, and then the NFL draft? Because my argument yesterday on the show was, if you made me draft topics to talk about, those would be my top three picks, and I wouldn't even blink at any of them. Way better than the NBA, Major League Baseball, the NHL. Football dominates, and even the draft, which obviously connects, it's the linchpin between college and pro football, continues to get more and more wildly popular. The past two seasons, highest ratings we've ever seen for the NFL draft on record.
I'll actually flip-flop college football and the draft. I think the draft
is bigger than college football. You would take it over.
I think it is definitely growing that way because it's something that doesn't show a regional bias. I mean, that's the reality of it. Hope springs eternal for all 32 franchises. And whether you're a Jacksonville Jaguars fan drafting first overall or you're a Kansas City Chiefs or Tampa Bay Bucks fan drafting at the bottom of the first round, you're tuning in. Whereas college football over the last couple of years, we can pencil in three of the four teams, especially in the national landscape, for the semifinals. Of course, you'll get your marquee games during the season, but I think the draft is a standalone event, probably bigger than college football behind only the NFL.
It's pretty interesting. Let's go into the draft for a moment here. There's a lot of attention on it. Did any futures odds change in a substantial way based on Thursday, Friday, Saturday? I'm going to get to Aaron Rodgers, so I'm not asking particularly about that, but just the guys that were actually drafted. Or had the market pretty much priced in everything and we didn't see much movement based on what happened in the draft?
Substantial, no, but there was one team that saw their odds tick down a touch, and that was the Chicago Bears. They, of course, went from 50-1 thereabouts out to 60-1 after signing Andy Dalton. But we saw FanDuel drop their odds in that 50-1 range. And that's as much speculative as it is anything else, knowing how popular a fan base the Bears are and how people want to put up a little bit to make a lot. You can accrue liability pretty quickly. And knowing that Ryan Pace traded out of number 20 up to number 11 to get the perceived franchise quarterback, do I think it materializes on the field this season? Absolutely not. But that is the one team that saw their odds improve after draft day.
And how much of that is, you know, sort of a scientific analysis of the overall talent versus just excitement from Chicago Bear fans, of whom there are many, as you said, that may have flooded in and said, hey, Justin Fields, Super Bowl, baby, like just because they're so excited about having him as a quarterback?
It is 100% the latter, more so than anything else. I don't think you could talk to any professional better out there that's going through and adjusting their power numbers, and they're going to make the Bears a Super Bowl contender after acquiring Justin Fields there, because I don't think he even starts week one. If you're Matt Nagy and you're Ryan Pace, what better way to give yourselves another year of job security than keeping your rookie quarterback on the bench for his entire first season, or at least extended portions of it? So it won't change anything from a win totals market or anything along those lines, but it's more books protecting themselves from potential liability that can accrue.
All right, this is fun. We've known each other for what, like almost 15 years, whatever the heck it is. You've been coming on radio for a long time now. But one of the first times that I remember the line, you like to say a phrase, the line tells a story. One of the first times that I remember you pointing this out was when Johnny Manziel was a little bit under duress surrounding his eligibility off the field because of autographs and everything else. And I think it was the early season game against Alabama. The line started to move fairly substantially, and the only player that could have been involved was Johnny Manziel. And then, boom, the story comes out about the alleged autograph-related situation. That's probably been, I don't know, a decade ago or whatever the heck it was, 9-10 years ago that happened now. The reason why I use that as an example is people have gotten more sophisticated in using line moves to kind of gauge where stories might be going. And you probably can tell where I'm headed here with Aaron Rodgers. What have the futures odds for the Green Bay Packers done, and what have the futures odds done for the Denver Broncos, who are the team that I think he's going to end up on over the past week or so as this story has basically blown up since Thursday?
Well, funny story about that, because when those rumors were starting to swirl on draft day, the first thing, as most bettors are going to do, you're going to scramble and try and figure out what the prices are. So I actually went to one of the books out here in Las Vegas, was able to get a piece of the Denver Broncos at 40-1, knowing that, hey, it's a shot in the dark more than anything else. Probably about 15 minutes later, because our city is so small, one of the bookmakers actually texted me and went, do you believe this rumor, or are you just betting it more as speculation than anything else? So they ended up moving the number as low as 20 after my bet, just kind of cutting it in half. And again, it wasn't anything substantial, but you did see books that had the Broncos as high as 60-1. Have to try and hedge against some of that potential and the risk, because you know that people are going to follow the rumor mill, and oftentimes where there's smoke, there's fire. So if you can lock up a ticket at 60-1, thinking that the Broncos start the season at 20-1 if they acquire Aaron Rodgers, you have to try and take that chance, the same way that we talk about it all the time with NBA free agency. Now, of course, if Denver goes in the season with Teddy Bridgewater and Drew Lock. I've made a charitable donation, and I'll just have to write it off on my tax statement at the end of the year. But I do think that the Denver Broncos are very much in the mix for Aaron Rodgers. Now, as it pertains to the Green Bay Packers, what's interesting there is you've seen their win total pulled off the board everywhere, but books won't take the Packers up to the price that'll be available if we know Aaron is definitely traded out of town, because that's the luxury they have in a higher hold market that is the NFL futures. They can keep Green Bay in that 8-1 range, 10-1 range, and as soon as Rodgers gets traded, jack them up to 50-1, but there's no reason for them to move that number prematurely and take on Green Bay Packers money if there's a chance that Aaron could still be their starting quarterback when we're talking about week one later this September.
So that's pretty fascinating. So the move primarily in terms of unlocking value came on the Broncos, who were up around 60-1, and they now have come down to around 20-1 at some shops anyway.
Yep, and the number is stabilized. You'll see some books keep that price artificially low. You'll see other books kind of drift back into that nebulous area because they don't want to discourage people from betting Denver. But there's a real chance, much like we saw last year with the Tom Brady sweepstakes, people were trying to bet as many different futures as they possibly could for
right.
teams that they thought could realistically land Tom, and whether it was the Tennessee Titans or the Indianapolis Colts or the Tampa Bay Bucks, the early bird gets the worm, and if you thought he was going to land in Tampa or happen to have that information, you could have a ticket on the Bucks at 60-1. I, of course, made the case that Jameis Winston was going to make them a contender, so I won't profess to have that foresight that I thought TB12 was going to take his talents down there to the Gulf Coast of Florida.
So just kind of letting people know right now, the Green Bay Packers are 17-1 at FanDuel, and the Denver Broncos are 24-1 at FanDuel to potentially win the Super Bowl. So the Broncos have surged up, and the Packers have actually come back a decent amount at FanDuel, where I think you said like 10-1-ish was kind of where the Packers were.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the challenges, and it's part of one of the more exciting parts about being a bookmaker. When it comes to futures, that you get to play this cat and mouse game, it's not the same risk threshold necessarily that you'll see week to week when you anxiously await the status of a marquee quarterback, in this case Aaron Rodgers, who can move the number upwards of 9 points in his prime, whereas in a futures book, if you happen to take on a few bets that you didn't want to take at much higher numbers than where the market will go off, you have 9 to 10 months to try and attract wagers everywhere else. And so that was one of the things that I really enjoyed when it came to setting future markets, trying to figure out the adjustments in personnel, which players could really move the needle, and then ultimately putting myself in a spot to balance the books as you got closer to when they were actually going to hand out the hardware.
One of the things that is tough to analyze, but it seems like it's pretty clear just based on the pick that they made, Davis Mills going to the Houston Texans is as clear of a sign to me as is almost possible that Deshaun Watson is not playing for the Texans in 2021. And I haven't even paid a lot of attention to Texans odds, but has that been factored in the marketplace in terms of the likelihood that Deshaun Watson is eligible and or playing in 2021 based on his off the field related issues?
It was evident in their win total. The Houston Texans had the lowest win total in the entire National Football League. That number I saw as low as 4.5. And of course, with the addition of another game, that's not exactly a spot you want to be in. So I think bookmakers believe that Deshaun Watson will be a long shot to be under center, especially for the entire regular season. Maybe he plays a portion. But as you talk about the Texans trying to figure out their next direction, Davis Mills and Deshaun Watson, very different skill sets. So it is interesting if you're going to draft a quarterback as high as they did to kind of be the backup that can't run the offense the same way that Watson will. So you hate to say that there is something to be read in the tea leaves, but I'm not optimistic about Watson's status for this season, and we'll figure out exactly what it means above and beyond.
All right. It's going to be a complicated year for futures in the NHL and in the NBA as we get closer and closer to the playoffs in both of those places. So I'm going to ask you, because I'm not even an expert exactly in how this is going to be played. I know that doesn't shock you, but the play-in, let's start in the NBA. The play-in scenario, which LeBron James is all fired up about, and which the Mavs were fired up about earlier, everybody hates the play-in playoff scenario if their team is potentially going to have to be involved. The Lakers are still the second most likely team to win the championship, according to oddsmakers right now. But walk us through what that play-in scenario does to, in terms, I mean, basically adds another round of the NBA playoffs and how that would impact futures odds as you look forward there.
Well, Well, the crazy part about it, if it wasn't the Lakers' potential to be involved in that 7 through 10 matchup, I don't think any of the teams that are in a play-in type scenario, whether they're in the Eastern Conference or the Western Conference, have aspirations of winning the Larry O'Brien Trophy. So the fact that the Lakers have remained second favorites on the board, despite the fact that they could have to just win a couple of games to even get into the playoff mix, is somewhat ironic and entertaining all on the same level, especially when you look at their upcoming schedule in the wake of last night's game against Denver. But as you try and go through and figure out what it means from a futures implication standpoint, the short answer is nothing. Now, to FanDuel's credit, they've drifted the Lakers' odds out, and it's probably one of the best prices in the market at 4.5 to 1, where they have held relatively steady in that 3-3.5 range. The Nets, by virtue of some of the rigorous road that teams are going to have to go through in the Western Conference, remain the de facto favorite at 6-1. But I can tell you, the Lakers' potential struggles are definitely a boon for the likes of the Utah Jazz, the Phoenix Suns, and if you believe in the Denver Nuggets, widely available at 36-1.
So would you still be buying stock in the Lakers right now? They haven't been that great since LeBron James came back. Obviously, LeBron still recovering in some way from the high ankle sprain. Anthony Davis looks, I think it's fair to say, nowhere near his peak ability. I think you and a lot of other people out there, me, certainly anticipate that by the time the playoffs start, a lot of NBA teams are basically kind of getting themselves in position to be at their peak by the time the playoffs get here. Is there still value on the Lakers here, or are you getting apprehensive about their ability to proverbially flip the switch here?
You know, 4.5 to 1 is a number that I want to dig into a little bit more, because I think that might be a price point that I'd be willing to whet my appetite on the Lakers. Haven't jumped in, don't have a ticket on them at any particular price, but there's also another school of thought that you can wait out the regular season, see how the seedings are going to look, and then make a more informed decision at that point, because the Lakers are without the services of Dennis Schroeder now too. So while we talk about the Nets and their big three not having a chance to build chemistry, a couple of the key cogs for the Lakers won't spend a lot of time on the floor over the last 4 to 6 weeks of the regular season before they start playing meaningful basketball. So for those folks that may want to invest in the Lakers, can ride out the regular season, I can't see a scenario where this price changes a ton. And in the wake of some of LeBron's comments about how this recovery from the ankle injury was more stressful than anything else he's had to go through to get back on the court, sometimes you want to try and read between the lines, and maybe this Lakers team won't be nearly as dynamic as the group that we saw win the title in the bubble last year.
Oh, it's been crazy in the NHL this year. The Canadian teams have not been crossing the border. They've been playing, and you've been betting all these Canadian games on a regular basis. How is the NHL playoffs going to look compared to past years, and how would you go about trying to assess how that impacts Stanley Cup odds?
So a little bit of a different format here. Every division will be self-contained. So we'll get the NHL down to a final four. All these teams that have played anywhere from 8 games against the same opponents upwards of 10 will still have to go through those similar opponents. You'll have 4 teams from each division. One champion of each division will emerge, and that's where things can really get interesting when we try and figure out which of these teams is actually battle-tested and who benefited from just playing some of the lightweights. I do think it makes for a much more compelling Stanley Cup Finals. We talk about the parity in the NHL making it one of the greatest postseasons there is. And this year, you're going to have some of the best teams where, in my opinion, you should probably shy away from betting some of the favorites now, because a team like the Colorado Avalanche or Vegas Golden Knights that are the favorites at FanDuel as we sit here would have to play each other in the second round of the playoffs and still win 2 more series to hoist the Stanley Cup. So don't look at some of the shorter odds that are out there. If I'm trying to identify a little bit of value, I think 2 teams hailing from the Eastern Conference make the most sense, and that would be the Bruins at 13-1 and the Penguins at 14-1. I think one of those 2 teams comes out and they play a brand of hockey, if they have the right matchup in that final four, that can get them to the Stanley Cup and allow you to earn against that ticket.
We're talking to Todd Furman at Todd Furman on Twitter. Will you, I don't even know the answer to this, so we're going to have a late into the season in both hockey and in the NBA, and then we run right into the Olympics. Are you an Olympics gambler? Like, will you actually have odds that you are playing off of? Will you gamble the Olympics? Because the reason why I ask, this is going to be the first Olympics, I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong, where in theory there would be a lot of action in a lot of different states, because 4 years ago, or 5 years ago, I guess it was, when the last Olympics happened, there was no legalized, in quotation marks, sports gambling in America outside of Vegas, for instance. There are going to be a ton of people looking down at their phones come July who suddenly have the ability to bet on, I don't know, every track and field event known to man. Will this be something that you dive into, and how do you expect gambling in terms of popularity to work? Not to mention, and this is kind of funny in and of itself, with the time differential, you'll probably have knuckleheads pulling out their phone trying to bet on things that have already happened, which is kind of funny to think about as well.
Yeah, I'll dabble a little bit. I won't claim to do a whole heck of a lot when it comes to some of the track and field events. Clearly, basketball lends itself a little bit better to a wagering standpoint. But you're right, the times differences are going to create a real wrinkle for people that are looking to bet these things when they're watching the events unfold in prime time, knowing that they've been over for 10 to 12 hours. So in my opinion, I think some of the enthusiasm that any of these operators will have as it pertains to betting handle on the Olympics should be tempered just because of time zones, where if you were talking about an Olympics in Atlanta or somewhere in North America, much different story, because you know when the basketball game is going to tip and you had 15 or 20 minutes to get your bet in, whereas people aren't going to be nearly as in tune late in the summer trying to figure out exactly when the 4x100 relay is going to go at 3:23 in the afternoon in Tokyo time, which may be an ungodly hour of the day here stateside.
It is kind of wild to think about, isn't it? Because you remember, as somebody who is obviously a big sports fan, but I was working, I think, at Deadspin during the 2008 Summer Olympics. And if I remember correctly, those took place in Beijing, if I'm remembering again correctly. And the way that we handled it at Deadspin was we held the results until, you know, because they were airing 12 hours later, as you just mentioned, based on the fact that they were going on in Beijing. And the internet was popular in 2008. And I'm not pretending that it wasn't, but social media hadn't really taken off. I'm curious how much of the storylines of the Olympics are going to still matter when every result is discussed in real time on social media.
I think it's changed, and it's changed quite a bit over the years for just the reasons there that you mentioned. People have access to it. NBC will offer plenty of live streams, and while some of the best content they'll try and hold back for primetime, it's an event now in the modern world that when you're talking about a 12-hour time difference to a lot of spots in the States, that it doesn't have that same appeal, because people do know the results. Those bets, if they happen to have wagered on them, will get graded well in advance, and it takes away a little bit of that luster and the magic where you all would tune in on prime time, not knowing the results of, you know, men's and women's gymnastics or figure skating or some of the higher profile events that typically bring in massive numbers as far as TV ratings are concerned.
I started off the show talking about my wild idea. I'm curious what you think about this wild idea. What do you think the Packer response would be if the Texans called them and said, we'll trade? And I'm not saying Aaron Rodgers would do it, but if they said, we'll trade you Deshaun Watson for Aaron Rodgers straight up.
I think when you talk about a franchise like Green Bay, that they're not going to get themselves tangled into that web. And if you believe that Jordan Love is the quarterback of the future and the reason you used first-round draft capital on him last year, you have to kind of let him develop. And I don't think you get yourself into the will he or won't he be available in Deshaun Watson. So you probably have to turn that down. Whereas if you're Green Bay and Denver offers you three number one picks and a couple of players that you can plug in right away, I think that provides a much more attractive draft package.
Good stuff as always, Todd Furman. I will see you later this afternoon on our television program. Thanks for hanging.
Always a pleasure, my good man.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
It is time for Petros Papadakis at The Old P on Twitter, 570 AM LA Sports with the Petros and Money Show. We were just talking about the open of hour three, one of the biggest stories coming out of the NFL draft, Aaron Rodgers. Do you have a strong opinion one way or the other on the Aaron Rodgers situation at all? Do you find yourself thinking, hey, I understand where Aaron Rodgers is coming from. This is a ridiculous kind of situation that the Packers have put him in with drafting Jordan Love? Or do you find yourself like, Aaron Rodgers, a lot of drama. I think he should just shut up and complete his contract.
Well, I'm much more leaning toward the latter on Aaron Rodgers. And one of my favorite people that I ever played with was Carson Palmer. And he was just like, he was built to be a quarterback and a leader. And he had a lot of ups and downs when I played with him at USC, not personally, just on the field. He threw a lot of picks and kind of wasn't living up to all the hype to a certain degree until Norm Chow got a hold of him. And he won a Heisman Trophy in 2002 and then was the number one pick and all that. But I always just admired him for what a great teammate he was, how he took criticism, what a tough guy he was, taking hits. He was always the same in the huddle. And I've always kind of washed Carson's balls to a certain degree whenever anybody asked about him, because he was a big recruit and he played his ass off and he competed his ass off and he worked his ass off and he cared. But that stuff he pulled in Cincinnati wasn't cool. And I didn't know him. I wasn't very close with him at that time, really close with him at all after college. And I know that Cincinnati's supposed to be a dysfunctional pro football team, and I'm not just dismissing that. But you said the word right there. You just said it, contract. And you sign a contract, you know what the people are like that you signed with. You've been there a long time. You know what the place is like. You signed the contract, and you took their money. And then he had a giant kind of temper tantrum, I guess, would be kind of a mean way to say it. But that's what Aaron Rodgers did, too. Contact all the people in the media.
Yep.
Tell them how unhappy you are. Spray it across social media. Aaron was even worse because he did it on the draft vindictively.
Yep.
To take over the draft and a bunch of young people having the day of their life. And what a vindictive, kind of selfish and self-centered thing to do to a bunch of people that have nothing to do with you or Green Bay or who they drafted last year. Like, who cares? And it's a terrible look. There's no doubt about it. Like, at least Carson didn't try to take over the draft. He just tried to get the hell out of Cincinnati. And I think they had more success when he left and went to the Raiders and didn't have a lot of success there and then had a bit of a renaissance in Arizona. And, I mean, far be it for me to criticize, but I'm just using the example because I'm paid to criticize that it just doesn't work like that in football. It's too fleeting of a thing. You know, the same as the Russell Wilson situation. Like, I don't care what Russell Wilson says or does. He seems like the biggest dildo on earth. Like, he's a dork. He's a great football player. But everything he does, he seems like a dork. He uses a different accent every time he talks. Like, he's a weird dude. But it doesn't matter. None of it matters. Until he said, he went on the show that follows you in most markets, Dan Patrick's show, and he said, well, these other guys on the team, you know, my legacy and this and that. And look, football's a live bullets game that ruins your body, and you see a lot of really gnarly, nasty things, and in a perfect world, it probably wouldn't exist. I promise you, not one of those guys out there playing this game to make a living in a very dangerous situation and being paid well for it, they're not worried about your legacy. And that kind of self-absorption that we see in the NBA and sort of just take for granted now in the NBA, where we don't even blink our eyes anymore at some of this massive, I don't know what you'd call it, vanity from a lot of these players. Well, it just doesn't fly in football in the same way because there's too many guys out there and they're too much at risk and your success is so fleeting. So it's a long answer, but there's an old example where Carson, I thought, really screwed up and kind of screwed up his legacy, so to speak, in Cincinnati. There's a situation with Aaron Rodgers, and then there's earlier in the year with Russell Wilson talking about his legacy on sports radio before he's done playing. What an idiot.
We're talking to Petros Papadakis. It is kind of fascinating, right, to think about how exactly – and he went to the Kentucky Derby. And again, I think the big part of the story here that we've talked about as well, he made the choice to go public with this story on the day of the NFL draft. And people can say, well, he didn't talk – like his agents, they don't make this choice. This has been playing out for weeks now. They decided to get maximum attention here.
It doesn't matter. You can be a Hollywood guy and be married to a famous person and talk to everybody in the media whenever you want or get whatever kind of attention you want and be Tom Brady and be a great teammate, right? Aaron Rodgers, he doesn't seem that way to me. You know, he seems like a guy who's never happy with anything. And it's football. It's a terrible, imperfect thing. It's like a rock fight. Like, how do you screw up a rock fight? I mean, I know that every football player you ever talk to, Clay, you could get Joe Montana on and give him true serum, and he's going to tell you he got effed along the way at every place he's ever been. That's all of us. No matter what level you finished on, if you played a higher level of football, you know, 90% of the time you feel like you got screwed or effed in one way or another. To go public with it and have your agent call Schefter and Glazer during the draft, that's going to be hard to live down. I mean, it was a really ugly look, and I hope people don't forget it when he has another Hollywood girlfriend or when he and this one break up.
We're talking to Petros Papadakis. All right, the other big news, I would say, is the Lakers. LeBron James has come back. They have lost their first two games. He didn't play last night. Anthony Davis hasn't looked great. How much discussion about the Lakers is there in L.A., and do you believe that this talk about the play-in series and everything else, are the Lakers in trouble as a title contender in your mind?
Well, I mean, I'm no basketball analyst, but our basketball,
join the club. Yes.
Yeah. Our basketball analysts have said, you know, because we, you know, you basically asked the same question about the Lakers to everybody for the last few weeks, if not months, which is, you know, when are these guys coming back? Will they be ready for the playoffs? And everybody says the same thing. They say, well, yeah, you know, as long as they get back in time so they don't have to go to that play-in.
Yeah.
It's like, well, okay, well, now
They're in the play-in, potentially, yeah.
Yeah, they're staring the play-in in the face, and LeBron is starting to bitch about it. And
which is funny, because, by the way, to LeBron's credit, the Dallas Mavericks did the same things. Everybody likes the idea of a play-in when they think they don't have to play in it, and as soon as they do, they're like, wait, whoever came up with this idea? You know, like,
yeah, this is horrible.
Yeah, right.
So I expect that to make a little bit of news. But I mean, I wouldn't be telling you the truth if I didn't tell you that interest has waned in the NBA considerably, even in this town where the Lakers are a gigantic brand, which is not to say there's still people that are in love with the Lakers. But first of all, like, we had to read the rules to go to a game at Staples Center on air.
Yeah.
Cause we do Clipper stuff, I guess. And I mean, the thought that anybody would want to go through that, let alone pay to go through that.
Right.
And to go to like a designating roped off eating area where you stand like a sheep and eat as quickly as you can so you can get back. I mean, it's just,
it's not a fun environment.
It's not worth it. You know,
yeah.
It's just, it doesn't seem worth it. And it doesn't seem like, I mean, things could change and the playoffs could change and LeBron could, I don't know. But there doesn't seem to be a lot of interest. And I do believe that there are a lot of people pretty turned off by it at this point. The other thing going on in town is that the Dodgers are struggling.
Yeah.
And have been struggling much more than people thought. And yes, it's April, but it's pretty clear that they're not the same baseball team that won that shortened season. So you got both these teams that won last year under very odd circumstances. I mean, the Dodgers played every World Series game and most of the playoffs in Texas. and you have them trying to repeat as favorites, and right now neither of them are living up to expectations, kind of treading water and sinking.
Yeah, you know, it is interesting in that respect. And the other, this is a big question for you, and I know you're not a huge fan of social media in general, but I was just talking about this to start off the show. If social media didn't exist, right, if we were like, let's say social media isn't going to be invented in the way that it exists now until 2028, right, and LeBron has already finished his career and he plays for most of his career in the same sort of rough environment that Jordan did, is LeBron more or less popular because of social media in your mind? And in a bigger picture, the question that I was asking to start off the third hour of the program is, how many stars out there? I don't mean like role players. I don't mean like side actors. You know, like, for instance, us in media, I think social media can in many ways help us. Certainly it's helped me, but it also can come with its downsides. But in general, how would you say that social media has impacted LeBron James's popularity. He has 50 million Twitter followers, however many that he has on Instagram as well. Do people like him more or less than if he didn't have social media at all?
It really is, since you've been explaining it. I thought the answer was really easy when you first started asking it, but I don't think it's a, I think it's a really complex answer. And I think it really can be applied to all of us to a certain degree, right? Social media exposes you to a lot more people than you would normally be exposes some form of you,
yes,
right? Some your opinion, what you want to write down on Twitter, whatever pictures you want to put up, but some arm of your being, social media exposes you to a lot more people than you would normally be exposed to. And so it's not only an opportunity for a lot more people to like you and a lot more people to revere you, but it's also an opportunity for a lot more people to hate you. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
So, and it's such a polarizing place that social media, like you said, that I use it. And obviously I remember you using it when I first met you, 2012, eight, 9 years ago.
Yeah.
I met you and you were attached to Twitter, and I understood it to a certain degree, and I understood it as important and growing. But also it's a place for kind of like, it's a lighter fare type of place for me, because it's a place that forces you to one side or the other. You know, you're not allowed to go on to social media and say, hey, LeBron's a great basketball player, but, you know, some of this stuff is not cool. You know, like, no one's going to be happy with you. You know, LeBron's people
If you try to come up with the least hot take comment, whatever it might be, right? Like, the most lukewarm comment that you could have. A pro or con. It's the same thing, by the way, with, for instance, like reviews on the internet. Everything is either a 1-star or a 5-star, right? Especially in our business. People are either like, man, I love that guy, or they're like, man, I hate that guy. Almost no one would be like, yeah, I'd give him a 2.5 to 3.5. He's pretty much just totally average. I don't really have a strong opinion one way or the other.
Yeah.
Social media, what works is strong opinions one way or the other.
And well, you also have to think about it like this. Think about it in the context of what we do, the lowest rung of the world of entertainment, sports talk radio, just this, what we're doing right now. When we were younger, when there was no social media, frankly, when I started in the business, it just started to turn, and thank God, we weren't people allowed to have strong opinions or be entertaining or have a lot of fun, because that wasn't our role. Our role was to be informational. The role was to tell people if LeBron was going to play tonight, because that information wasn't available to everybody on everybody's phone.
Yeah.
Now on the radio, you don't know anything that everybody else doesn't know in the moment. That's public.
That's right.
You don't.
It's very rare that there's even breaking news on this show, and we have to break out the breaking news sounder. Like, almost, I mean, doing this show 5 years, I think we've legitimately had breaking news that changes what we would talk about like 4 or 5 times in 5 years.
Well,
like basically once, and your time slot's a little bit different, but it almost never happens words here.
It's not different in a lot of ways, Clay, because so many people podcast shows.
Yeah.
Like, well, I didn't hear the show live, but it doesn't stop me from listening to it in beautiful, clear sound on iHeartRadio.
Yeah,
so it doesn't really matter if you had, what time
that's
you
a good
told
point.
The listeners
that's a great point.
Walker Buehler wasn't going to play, because, I mean, an overwhelming amount of the listeners are listening at their convenience, sometimes 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
Be entertaining and speak your most honest freaking show, and the most fun you can have is the best way to do it, now, because it's morphed. But with LeBron James or people like that, like, the more you put yourself out there publicly and touch these hot topics as an athlete or somebody, an actor or somebody like that, you're going to expose yourself to a whole country of people, and maybe half of those people are going to like you, where none of them would have known you. But now half of them like you and half of them hate you. You know,
that's my kind of point. Like, I understand it for purposes of guys who are on the periphery. Like, if you're an offensive lineman, right, on a football team, and you're witty and you're funny and you're good at social media, I can understand the benefit of being active, because people might not have known you otherwise. You were on that periphery. But, you know, Peyton Manning and Michael Jordan are pretty big names. They've never needed social media in order to be big names. They still don't have it. And I wonder on some level for LeBron whether the guys of that ilk, that magnitude, would be more popular without it. Now, I do think Tom Brady in the last couple of years has started using social media pretty well and made himself a little bit more likable than he might otherwise be because he seems so inaccessible. And when he's drunk and he puts out like a funny tweet afterwards, it makes him seem more likable. But I am just kind of fascinated by how quickly the universe in which we live in the world of sports has changed in general.
It is wild because you'd never think like, wow, I want to go watch LeBron James. And then, wait, maybe I don't because, you know, he kind of bugged me with what he said a couple weeks ago. Like, you know, that's going through more people's minds than, you know, you'd say, well, I don't like Michael Jordan because he beat my sons, you know, or he beat my Sonics or Trailblazers or Lakers or whatever. It's a lot different. And it's, I think it is, it's a problem for the NBA, obviously. And it's something that they need to address, but everybody has to like kind of come to terms with it in their league. And it's the long cut in football. I've made this point for a long time. Figure it out in your collective bargaining agreement. Figure out what is a proper form of protest and how you want to handle this new political climate that we're in that will satisfy the owners, the sponsors, all your social justice people, and then your normal sort of fans. And I don't know if you can do that. You know, that's going to be a tall order, but they're going to have to figure it out because right now we're kind of in a no man's land. And I think a lot of different platforms are suffering because of it. We've alienated each other so much that basically a lot of people can't even stand to look at each other.
Yeah, there's no doubt. Quickly, who's more popular in L.A. right now, LeBron James or Kobe Bryant?
Oh, Kobe.
Yeah,
Kobe Bryant.
It's not close,
you know, Kobe
right?
Felt like he was, you know, to people here in L.A., Kobe, you know, for all his warts and zits, and, you know, many of them have just been forgotten and forgiven because of the horrible, tragic way that he and his daughter many others died. And that's kind of been erased from our memory, especially locally. Kobe, for whatever he was, he felt like he was the city's. So LeBron James could be here for another 10 years and that wouldn't change.